Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 2nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first article, top of the fold, States Ports Rebound, Growth in Forecast, by Lee Weisbecker, from Wilmington. Those looking for a signal that North Carolina's economy is in rebound mode may want to check the waters at the state's two seaports, where fiscal 2012 turned out to be a snapback year, and new data reveal tailwinds pushing the operations toward continuing growth. Port officials believe deep recession-induced hits to international trade have given way to a revival that promises to make the state's cargo operations in Wilmington and Morehead City more profitable. A recent 7-year forecast commissioned by the North Carolina States Port Authority, or SPA, is helping to fuel the optimism. Both of the state's deep water facilities will see a moderate near-term expansion in terms of the amount of goods moved through them, the forecast says. General cargo, currently at 4.4 million tons per year, should hit 5.5 million tons by 2019. Meanwhile, container unit moves, now at 160,000 a year, will nearly double during the same time frame. Chief exports through the terminals are wood pulp and wood chips, followed by general merchandise. Chief imports are chemicals and grain. The long-range cargo projections were the work of Long Beach-based port and harbor specialist Moffett & Nickel, says SPA spokeswoman Shannon Moody. Future projections aside, fiscal 2012, which ended June 30th, was a rebound year for the ports, according to a year-end financial report released by the Office of State Auditor Beth Wood. The audit concludes that better numbers posted by the facilities are part and parcel of both the general global economic recovery as well as improvements in North Carolina agriculture and industrial sectors. Auditors found that revenue from operations at the Wilmington and Morehead City yards rose by 6% to $39.6 million during the 12 months. Meanwhile, operating income, essentially system profits, increased to $3.4 million, up from $260,000 in the prior year. Moreover, a combination of higher investment returns and more state and federal aid helped to increase total SPA net assets by $500,000 to $219 million. Roughly 71% of total revenue is generated by the Wilmington port. Rex Sherman, who keeps track of port cargo volumes for the Alexandria-based American Association of Ports Authorities, ranks Wilmington at number 28 among the top 50 U.S. ports in 2011, the latest year for which numbers are available. It occupied the same spot the year before, says Sherman. The Morehead City port is not ranked in the top 50. Competing ports in neighboring states consistently finish higher in the rankings. Among them in 2011, Savannah, number 4, Hampton Roads, number 8, and Charleston, number 13. It's the Charleston port that has been generating a lot of buzz recently, and that is expected to make a decisive move up in the rankings. C.K. Conway, who performed a late 2011 U.S. ports analysis for Colliers International, says Charleston's deeper approach channels, modernized computer system, and proximity to a new Boeing manufacturing plant mean it will compete for a top 5 ranking within 5 years. Next, demand down, SBA loans drop by 32% in North Carolina. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Small business lending through the Federal Small Business Administration program declined in North Carolina in the government's 2012 fiscal year, which ended September 30th. Loan numbers dropped by 32% to 839 during the 12 months, down from 1,244 in the prior year. Dollar volumes shrank by 2% to $554 million versus $566 million in 2011. Charlotte-based SBA spokesman Mike Hernandez attributed the decline to a decline in demand. "We can't really address why demand was down," he says. "We have an aggressive outreach program with our lenders. We make sure they are aware of SBA programs, and we recruit new lenders." Under the agency's most popular loan program called 7A, banks lend the capital after receiving a federal repayment guarantee in case of default. The SBA's 504 loan program, by contrast, requires a 10% contribution from the borrower, a 40% contribution from a federally backed development company, and 50% from a bank. Of the 839 loans made in the state last year, 706 were 7A loans, which the business borrowers use for expansion, to pay bills, hire new employees, and other general corporate purposes. More than 80 banks made SBA bank loans in federal 2012, with Winston-Salem-based BB&T sitting in the top position, having made 113 loans valued at a total of $18.7 million. Even so, another lender, San Francisco-based Wells Fargo, was making a claim of its own. "In terms of dollar, we were number one," says Jack Clayton, a Raleigh-based Wells Fargo executive who oversees 51 eastern North Carolina counties. According to SBA records, Wells Fargo made 110 loans valued at a total of $48.8 million. Meanwhile, Raleigh-based Vantage South, a community bank that has made SBA lending a priority, was third with 46 loans valued at a total of $48.6 million. "We are loving the competition between the banks," says Steve Mariani, whose Raleigh-based Diamond Financial helps clients structure SBA packages. Whatever SBA said happened, demand-wise over the past 12 months, the last 3 months for us have rocked, and the bank competition has brought us new lenders. The SBA has also been modifying its offerings. According to Hernandez, the agency recently rolled out a new program called Small Loan Advantage, aimed at lower-dollar borrowers. An earlier program, Community Express, was phased out in 2011 amid concerns over rising default rates. Highly popular, it got a quick cash of up to $50,000 in the hands of business borrowers, and its absence in 2012 may help explain why overall loan numbers fell by 32%. Still on the front page, this week's lead article, cranking up. Auto sales up by 14% in the Triangle in 2012. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Cary. If it seems like those funny little Italian Fiat cars are popping up like VW Beetles once did on the roads across the Triangle, they are. It's part of a resurgence in auto sales across North Carolina that is favoring more fuel-efficient smaller cars over the big trucks and SUVs of a few years ago. And that is forcing auto dealership owners to rethink how they do business and what brands they sell. Domestic and import auto sales nationally hit a low in 2009, but they are on track now to spring back to early 2008 levels of around 14.8 million annual units by the end of the year, according to forecasts by J.D. Power and Associates. In North Carolina, year-to-date auto sales in September were up by nearly 14% compared to the year prior, says Kathy Beck of the North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association, NCADA. In Raleigh, car sales were up by 19.5%, while truck sales were up by 9%. And small cars like the European Fiat and Mini Cooper are gaining ground on many of the older brands. The Fiat 500, which was introduced to the American public in late 2010, has already overtaken the Mitsubishi and Lincoln brands in the number of units sold in North Carolina. So far, this year, the two Fiat dealerships in the state and a third in a South Carolina suburb of Charlotte have sold 788 Fiat cars compared to the 115 car sales for the same time frame the year prior, according to a report from the NCADA. That makes it the fastest growing car brand in the state. Tom Blocker, chief operating officer of Hendrick Automotive Group in Charlotte and a native of Cary, says his company was lucky to have an empty building available when Fiat granted Hendrick a dealership in Cary in 2011. That dealership has the second highest volume in sales for Fiat in the Southeast, Blocker says, and all we have right now is one model, the 500. We're still in very early stages of Fiat. Hendrick, the second largest auto dealership owner in the region behind Leith, opened the Triangle's only Fiat dealership in spring 2011 at the Cary Auto Mall in a building that was left vacant after General Motors discontinued the Saturn brand. The company spent about $450,000 renovating the building and turning it into a contemporary studio to fit Fiat's requirements. Hendrick has seen such success with the brand in Cary that the company has been granted additional dealership rights in Fayetteville, which will open in November. Another is planned for Charlotte next year. Blocker estimates that the Fiat lot in Cary sells about 35 to 40 units a month, and it currently has more than 180 cars in inventory on the lot. Smaller cars have been gaining in popularity in recent years as drivers watch the rising fuel prices at the gas pump and opt for more fuel-efficient vehicles. The Fiat, for example, gets 32 to 38 miles per gallon on the highway, according to fueleconomy.gov, and the price for a base model 500 is $15,500. The 2012 model of the Mini Cooper, another European-designed car with a dedicated following among certain groups, gets 30 to 37 miles per gallon on the highway and is priced starting at $19,700. A total of 1,079 Minis have been sold in North Carolina this year, which is down by 1% from the year prior. Leaving the front page and moving to the inside, "I'm not going anywhere," says Nobel winner. "It's been incredible," says Robert Lefkowitz. This article is by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from Durham. Robert Lefkowitz can't stop grinning. "It's been incredible," he says, referencing inquiries ranging from TV's Charlie Rose to the White House, and the fanfare isn't stopping since he was chosen as a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. "It's been busy," administrative assistant Quivetta Lennon laughs in a major understatement. Lefkowitz has been invited to exotic locales, including India and China, but he doubts he'll leave his photograph-filled office at Duke University Hospital for long. When he arrived at Duke in 1973 after studying at Columbia University, he didn't see himself spending his life in Durham, but it came down to his personal motto, "If it's not broke, don't fix it. I'm not going anywhere." Now he's a fixture on campus and in the community. He and his wife have 5 children and 5 grandchildren, one of whom was celebrating her 17th birthday the day he learned about the Nobel. A native of New York, Lefkowitz now is into all things Duke, including the basketball team, which fettied him shortly after the prize announcement at the Blue Devils preseason public scrimmage and show. Lefkowitz does plan to leave Durham long enough to accept the award in Stockholm December 10, where he'll get a half hour to lecture his peers. "I would like them to come away with a sense of how remarkably far we have come in the past 40 years," he says. Lefkowitz not only is a chemist, he's also a businessman. The company he founded, Philadelphia-based Trevena, has in-trial drugs exploring the therapeutic applications of his science. Its most advanced compound is currently in phase 2 trials for the treatment of acute heart failure. Between all that's coming at him, the soon-to-be Nobel laureate took a few minutes to talk about the eureka moment that started it all. That was when he identified G-protein-coupled receptors more than 2 decades ago. What sounds like a complex term, G-protein-coupled receptors, is a family of receptors, the bread and butter of his career. The discovery didn't just net him the biggest prize in chemistry. It also netted information that could lead to a super blocker, a signaling molecule that could have a monumental impact on cardiology. The year was 1986, and Lefkowitz wasn't even a decade into his 39-year research career at Duke University. "We had been studying something called the beta-adrenergic receptor," he says. "It's the receptor to which beta blockers," you've heard of those, right, "bind, thus blocking the actions of adrenaline." He cloned the receptor to learn more about its sequence, and what he found made him giddy. We could immediately see it's closely related to rhodopsin, he says. Rhodopsin is a molecule in the retina that allows people to perceive light, he explains, adding that no one had found the similarity before. It immediately occurred to us that maybe all the receptors look alike, he says. So was born the idea of G-protein coupled receptors. Eureka. What's a eureka to us may not be a eureka to lay people, he jokes. It's completely changed or revolutionized the way they develop drugs. Modern scientists can take cloned receptors and put them directly into cells to see what they'll do, he says. Once we cloned the receptors, it sort of provided a Rosetta Stone, which allowed the cloning of essentially all the other receptors in this family, he adds. Dr. Victor Dalzou, Chancellor for Health Affairs and CEO of Duke University Health Systems, says the discoveries became the basis for a great many medications in use across many disease areas, not just cardiology. A more recent discovery could mean another impending breakthrough, a possible superblocker. The Lefkowitz team discovered that G-protein-coupled receptors activate another protein, beta-arrestin, which, when activated, can turn off sensitivity. By controlling specific signals, scientists may be able to control what they do, leading to a superblocker, one that could do the work of a beta blocker while also desensitizing. While he promises he'll keep researching at Duke, it's hard to be specific about what's next. He'll share the award with a former student, Brian Kolbika, who was a postdoctoral fellow in cardiology at Duke from 1984 to 1989, and is now at Stanford University. The pair have been collaborating and hope to further their research together, specifically in structural biology, visualizing the receptor molecules themselves, and he promises to continue in that collaboration. Next up, Duke Hospital Edition Mired in Legal Claims, by Jason DeBruin, from Durham. The Duke Medicine Pavilion, a major expansion of Duke University Hospital projected to open in July 2013, is beset by cost overruns and delays, governed by poor management and filled with design errors, claim a subcontractor. In a complaint filed on October 4th in Durham County Superior Court, M.C. Dean Incorporated, an electrical contractor based in Dulles, Virginia, claims that change orders at the pavilion have more than doubled the initial electrical contract of $31.5 million and that his company has not been paid for any work done since May. The company estimates it is owed at least $9 million for work already done and would be owed an additional $10 million to complete the contract. The complaint is filed against Duke University, KBR Building Group, the construction manager, and Perkins & Will, the architect with an office in Morrisville. Most of the complaint is directed at KBR Building Group, headquartered in Charlotte and a subsidiary of KBR Incorporated, a publicly traded company based in Houston. In the complaint, M.C. Dean indicates it believes Duke has paid KBR for the work, but that KBR has not passed that money on to them. The project has been beset by cost overruns and delays which have made M.C. Dean's work a fundamentally different undertaking than what was contemplated or agreed to, according to the complaint filed by C. Allen Foster and Eric C. Rowe of the Greenberg Traeg Law Firm in Washington, D.C. During the course of the project, however, Duke and KBR have directed M.C. Dean to perform vast amounts of additional work, far outside the scope of the original subcontract. The sheer magnitude of the changes to M.C. Dean's work in this case is virtually unparalleled. In total, M.C. Dean has had to deal with over 6,000 changed or reissued drawings, which nearly triple the scope of its original work. Foster says that the two companies, KBR and M.C. Dean, have been engaged in settlement talks. Representatives of KBR did not respond to requests for comment. In December 2010, Lutheran Cochran, chairman of the company's building group, said, "We are delighted to have been chosen to work with Duke Medicine on these compelling and extraordinary projects." Representatives of Duke did not return requests for comment. The project is one of which Dr. Victor Dalzou, Chancellor for Health Affairs and CEO of Duke University Health System, has been very complimentary. It calls for 608,000 square feet of space for surgical, imaging, and critical care that will add 160 critical care beds and 18 operating rooms. The $235 million, 267,000 square foot cancer center opened in February to fanfare, but it is only a portion of the new capital investments that were originally estimated at $700 million. The total project costs now are unclear. The primary factor in our decision to move forward with these projects is our sense of responsibility and conviction to ensure that we meet the current and projected demands for the high-quality healthcare services that patients have come to expect from Duke, Dalzo said in August 2009 when the project was announced. This project is all about our patients, faculty and staff, and our missions of clinical care, teaching, and pursuing breakthrough research. And now, cost of dental training going up for students at UNC. By Jason DeBruin from Chapel Hill. Before reaching into people's mouths with their dentistry utensils, students at the UNC School of Dentistry will reach a little further into their pockets to pay for higher fees. In addition to tuition and regular university-wide fees, dental students pay $6,464 in dentistry fees, mostly for instruments and equipment. Those fees are up by almost 30% compared to 2011-12, largely due to one special charge that had been frozen since the mid-1990s, instrument rental fees. Students in dental schools practice on patients, but since a full set of proper instruments can be very expensive, dental schools loan equipment to students. The fee to cover the cost had been frozen by the university at $1,500 for the past 15 years, but budget pressures led to a $1,000 increase to $2,500 this year. Even so, Robert Foy, Associate Dean for Financial Affairs, says UNC operates on a shoestring budget. Look at other schools. Ours is as low as you will find, he says, adding that some schools charge as much as $7,000 for that line item. Historically, that fee covered not only the instruments, but also sterilization products and salaries for staff who warehouse, sterilize, and generally take care of the instruments. As cost increased, the university shifted some of those salaries to state funds. Of course, those funds were slashed in the past few years, and that cost shift became impossible to sustain, hence the need for the fee increase, Foy says. I will have students who come talk to me about the fee increase, but after we explain it to them, they understand, he says. Still, increasing fees at nearly every university causes concern for those in the dental field, says Dr. Alec Parker, Executive Director of the North Carolina Dental Society. This severely limits their career choices and could have a negative impact on their plans to start a family, he says. Those major fee increases took effect this year, and the school is looking to increase other fees next year. Those would be small in comparison, however, increasing the dental equipment fee from $200 to $240. The Student Fee Advisory Committee approved the fee increase and is waiting final approval from the university. Dental equipment refers to the larger equipment that dentists share, while dental instruments refers to the smaller tools that each dentist used while peering into patients' mouths. Nationally, costs in higher education have been a much-discussed topic, although the average price at public four-year universities increased again in the 2012-13 school year. The jump wasn't the highest in recent memory, according to data published by the New York-based College Board, which closely tracks tuition and fees at colleges and universities. But the news about what students actually pay is less encouraging. From 2008 to 2009 and 2010 to 11, grant aid and tax benefits increased rapidly enough to cause the average net prices to decline, even in the face of tuition increases. In contrast, the average net price paid by full-time students enrolled in public four-year colleges increased measurably in 2012-13 for the second consecutive year, according to the College Board report. Colleges and universities, along with state and federal officials, share the concern of students and families, grappling with the rising price of a college education, wrote Sandy Baum, independent policy analyst for the College Board, in the report. She continues, continued effort to rein in costs and to provide sufficient public subsidies, both to public colleges and to students with financial need, are vital to the future of our society and our economy. Continuing inside this week's Triangle Business Journal, sequestration would pound work of early stage pharmas, by Lauren K. Onisorge, from the Research Triangle Park. Sequestration, the much-debated budget cuts that will go into effect in January, barring congressional action, could devastate early-stage pharma companies, particularly in innovation-rich areas such as the Triangle, which accounts for more than half of all North Carolina's NIH grants. Amanda Fine, spokeswoman for the National Institutes of Health, says sequestration would mean an 8% cut at the NIH, meaning it would have to halt or curtail research funding. Companies in North Carolina were working on projects funded by the $1.5 billion in active project grants from the NIH over the past year. Of those 2,741 grants, 2,268 were in the 4th Congressional District, which encompasses Raleigh, Durham, and Research Triangle Park. Those grants totaled $1.3 billion. Early-stage pharmas, the kind of companies that depend on those NIH grants to get off the ground, could be hardest hit, and that includes companies such as Hillsboro-based Interoptic. NIH funding has been an important source of revenue for Interoptic, CEO Brian Heaney says, adding that now that its product is entering the market, the grant funding is becoming a smaller percentage of that overall revenue. Fortunately, he says. Our current grant is secure, but sequestration would certainly impact some of the grants we've applied for, he says. Suzanne Babcock, CEO of Civatech Oncology, an RTP-based company that was awarded one of the 13 Phase 2 contracts for commercialization from the National Cancer Institute, a unit of the NIH, says sequestration would be devastating. I cannot imagine how many good technologies would not get off the ground if less were awarded next year. Babcock and team are working on a lung cancer device that would help oncologists target specific areas for radiation. The project we are working on will ultimately lower the cost of health care as well as improve patient survival rates because it will treat early-stage lung cancer in a less invasive manner, she says. The reductions in costs will actually save the federal government the grant amount thousands of times over. It isn't really a grant, but an investment that will pay a real return. She adds that biotechnology is an expensive industry and calls government support critical. Tom Pike, CEO of CRO Giant Quintiles in Durham, says sequestration would result in industry-wide devastation. The broader question associated with that is where the funding for the industry is going to come from, he says. If we don't take action, the pharma industry and the innovation associated with the pharma industry through investments could actually be harmed. Alexandria, Virginia-based nonpartisan Research America estimates that the $2.3 billion cut in NHI funding would mean a significant decrease in grants. Research America estimates that, along with cuts to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and the National Science Foundation would mean nearly $4 billion in lost research dollars. Next up, Campbell totes up strong for fiscal year as endowment steadies, by Jason DeBrun. From Buies Creek, buoyed by strong donations during the fiscal year that ended in May, Campbell University recorded one of its strongest years financially, increasing revenue by 15% and holding expense growth to half that percentage. Gifts have been strong, says Jim Roberts, University Treasurer and Vice President for Business, largely because of donations specifically for the new School of Osteopathic Medicine, slated to open in Buies Creek in fall 2013. Already, the university has raised $26 million toward the $60 million project, bringing it close to the goal of raising half the money from private donors. That goal was revised upward from $20 million when donations came in higher than expected, says Britt Davis, the university's vice president for institutional advancement. In terms of total revenue for the university, Roberts expect the final tally to come in around $193 million against $152 million in expenses. He gave projected numbers because the final numbers have not been audited. Part of the increased revenue came because of a 4% bump in tuition as well as an increase in student enrollment, Roberts says, but the majority of the increase came from the fundraising. In the 2011-12 fiscal year, the university took in nearly $20 million in donor money, according to Davis. As for the university's endowment, a casual glance would show a decrease, but that has more to do with timing than anything else. Campbell reports the endowment's performance on May 31st, which was this year one of the lowest days for the stock market in recent memory. At that point, the endowment stood at $111 million, down from $118 million at the same point in 2011. However, the markets have since rebounded, and Campbell's endowment now sits at a more comfortable $120 million. Slicing the numbers in even more directions, the endowment is up 12% since January 1st and up 21% over the past 12 months, says Roberts. Those, again, are just point-in-time comparisons, so timing plays a big role in how the numbers shake out. Campbell uses the majority of its endowment for scholarships, as do many other universities. On average, Campbell draws 4% of the endowment annually for scholarships, or about $4.5 million this year. For the past few years, it has put the endowment to other uses, pulling $30 million out as a safety net for the new medical school. Accreditation bodies require universities to hold money aside in escrow, in Campbell's case, the $30 million, while winding up a new school. It's a worst-case scenario fund for students in case the program does not pass muster. In such cases, the escrowed amount would be used to pay for students to attend programs at other universities. Students of Osteopathic Medicine award graduates with a Doctor of Osteopathy, OD, instead of a medical doctor degree, MD, as do, for example, the med schools at Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and East Carolina University. Total enrollment in such osteopathic schools is on pace to hit a record for the 10th consecutive year, says Tom Leviton, Vice President for Research and Application Services at the American Association of Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine, headquartered in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Enrollment nationally hit 21,600 this year, a 4.5% increase from 2011. And this year, 20% of all medical students in the U.S. attended osteopathic medical schools. Continuing on, Rex, Wake Med, and Duke vying for 12 lucrative rehab beds. By Jason DeBrun. This article is from Raleigh. Hospital executives have kicked up the level of their competitive juices again, this time in a battle for rehabilitation services. The gusto with which each hospital approaches the competition accentuates how lucrative these services can be and highlights the stiff competition that circulates in the local healthcare market. At stake are 12 rehabilitation beds, something Duke Raleigh Hospital, UNC Hospitals, and Wake Med Health and Hospitals all want. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services regulates the inventory of healthcare services in an effort to keep costs low and will decide how to divvy up the beds based on a Certificate of Need, or CON, application submitted by each hospital. In addition to supporting their own projects, hospital executives may criticize applications of their competitors, something they never seem shy to do. In most cases, hospitals claim their competitors submit unrealistic projections, meaning the beds would sit empty at that hospital when they could properly be used at their own. Another common claim is that the competing hospital would only duplicate an existing service already offered somewhere else. Wake Med especially lays claim to rehabilitation services, as it already operates the largest such hospital in the area, an 84-bed unit, one that will grow to 98 beds at the end of this year. At a more than 91% occupancy, it also ran the highest average annual utilization rate in 2009, 2010, and 2011. UNC Hospitals has a 30-bed unit in Chapel Hill that operated at 80 to 85% capacity for the past 3 years. Duke Raleigh has no existing beds, so it would start a new unit. Because a rehab unit employs many specialists, a larger unit can better defray costs, says Stan Taylor, Wake Med's vice president for corporate planning. He made the utilization case especially over Duke Raleigh. The hospitals are separated by fewer than 5 miles. Flipping the argument, Duke Raleigh president Doug Vinsel says that allowing Duke to start a rehab unit would bring more competition to the market. Competition is good, he says. Our proposal will offer Wake County residents a local choice for meeting their rehabilitation needs. Wake Med proposes not only to add beds, but also to transform the unit into more private rooms. The existing hospital has only semi-private rooms, which Elaine Rolick, Executive Director of Rehab and Trauma Services, says is the biggest complaint I receive from patients, family members, and staff, more than all other complaints combined. If approved, Wake Med would build a new rehab tower with 49 private rooms at the cost of $25 million. The UNC Hospital's project would cost $2.7 million, and Duke Raleigh proposes to spend $4.2 million. Although the three hospitals each applied for 12 beds, there are actually 20 beds available. A fourth player, Johnston Health in Smithfield, applied for 8 of those beds, with the competition more or less ceding those to Johnston. Of course, the state could still deny Johnston's application and award those 8 beds to one of the other applying hospitals. This proposed project is not just about inpatient beds. It's about providing a needed service to the community that is not available in the county today, says Chuck Elliott, Johnston Health President and CEO. Last year, more than 200 Johnston County residents left the county to receive inpatient rehab care. Continuing on, Census goes with the flow toward building smart water meters. By Chris Bagley, from Morrisville. Utility metering company, Census, is expanding briskly at its engineering facility off Davis Drive as it seeks to meet demand for the newest generation of smart water meters. The facility's headcount has grown to about 160, up from 140 late last year, and is expected to grow to 180 next year. Vice President of Engineering Dave Ayers says, the company employs about 215 people at its headquarters in Raleigh and about 3,600 people worldwide. Utility companies and municipalities nationwide are replacing analog meters with digital meters. Most of the new models can report usage data monthly via radio signal, which cuts the expense of sending an employee or contractor out to read each meter each month. Most of the newest models can provide usage data in increments as short as 15 minutes, prompting customers to use the services more efficiently. And two-way communication devices in some meters allow a utility to control meters remotely. While falling natural gas prices may have eased the rush to improve gas and electricity efficiency, Ayers says the same isn't true of water use. In the future, water will be a more scarce resource, he says. Water is a high-growth area for Census. Rick Martin, editorial director for energy consultant Pike Research, estimates that metering companies will ship about 13,000 smart water meters worldwide in 2016, up from about 2,000 this year. The market for smart gas meters is expected to grow to about 8 million units, from about 2.7 million today, while the smart electricity meter market is expected to grow to 84.3 million, up from 74.5 million, Martin says. Amid the waves of new meters, Census hit a snag in September in connection with incidents during the summer in Philadelphia, where about 15 of its electricity meters caught fire. PECO, an electrical and natural gas utility serving the area, has blamed the fires on overheating meters. PECO has suspended installation of Census meters while continuing to use Census communications infrastructure. Census says improper installation may have caused the fires. In Morrisville, Ayers says the water meter segment's spurt in demand owes partly to improved battery technology. Unlike electrical meters, which have a power source, water meters rely on batteries, and Ayers says those in Census's newest water meters are designed to last 15 years. One model of water meter measures water flow by monitoring the electromagnetic current that it generates. No moving parts to make contact with the water. 20 of the 40 Census hardware engineers in Morrisville work specifically on water meters, with the remainder split among electricity meters, gas meters, and other hardware, Ayers says. One crucial category of Census hardware includes the circuit-filled boxes that utilities mount on cellular and other communication towers to relay wireless signals between the meters and their operation centers. A Census engineering center in Covington, Louisiana, focuses more heavily on electricity meters. The bulk of the engineers in Morrisville, 55 of them, develop and test software that's common to all three types of utility service. The Raleigh area has developed a cluster of companies focused on software and gear for managing utility use. Such companies employ more than 1,900 people statewide, primarily in the Triangle, up from about 1,550 in 2011, according to annual surveys by the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. The group's research director, Rich Crowley, cautions that the numbers aren't directly comparable because of changes in methodology. This week's spotlight is on real estate, and this article is entitled, No Vacancies, A Good Problem to Have, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from Zebulon. U.S. Foods has long been one of the largest employers in eastern Wake County, with its busy warehouse and food distribution facility located across from Five County Stadium in Zebulon. But when the supplier to hundreds of restaurants, hotels, and other food establishments needed to expand, U.S. Foods had few options but to build. The eastern Wake County submarket is one of the largest warehouse submarkets in the Triangle, but vacant buildings for companies needing to expand there are sparse. All of the warehouse buildings in the Walnut Creek Business Park in East Raleigh, for example, have been 100% occupied for more than a year, and the Greenfield Industrial Park in Garner has no available warehouse space either. Strong demographics were part of the draw when Duke Realty Corp. of Indianapolis paid $31 million for the 228-acre Greenfield North Park a year ago. But the bigger draw was the availability of land to build more warehouses in Eastern Wake, says Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Duke Raleigh's operation. Duke Realty also owns Walnut Creek. We'd been looking at other vacant land options, but Greenfield had the platform we needed already for future growth, Sheehan says. He estimates Duke Realty could build another 800,000 square feet of warehouse or flex buildings in Greenfield. The Eastern Wake submarket, which stretches from Rollsville, Zebulon, and Wendell near the Franklin County and Nash County lines down to Garner and the Johnston County line, has always been able to draw companies that want access to customers and businesses in eastern North Carolina. In the Triangle, The Interstate 40 corridor near Raleigh-Durham International Airport is still the number one choice for most companies seeking warehouse space. But lower land costs in Eastern Wake and neighboring Johnston County can often sway a decision, says Ed Brown, a senior broker at NAI Carolinic Realty in Raleigh. The two deals I worked on this year in that region went there for two reasons. They already had employees living over there, and the rental rates were competitive, he says. Rosemont, Illinois-based U.S. Foods and its predecessor companies have been supplying food establishments across eastern North Carolina from the Zebulon facility for nearly 20 years, expanding the building as needed. In 2007, it added 100,000 square feet of warehouse space for produce, meat, and dry storage, bringing the total under roof to 427,800 square feet, according to Wake County records. Now the company wants to add another 129,000 square feet of freezer and warehouse space to the Zebulon facility, according to a development review application submitted to the town in September. The application shows that U.S. Foods employs about 300 people in Zebulon and expects to add up to 50 more positions with the expansion. Company spokeswoman Lisa Likas says the company is not ready to talk about the project and would provide no further details. Julie Spriggs with the Zebulon Planning Department says the expansion plan for U.S. Foods is under review by the town's technical review committee. A final decision regarding U.S. Foods' application is expected in November. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. This article is entitled, Group Boost Private Higher Education in North Carolina. At some of the private colleges and universities in North Carolina, up to 80% of students represent the first generation in their family to go to college. And because only 27% of adult North Carolinians hold baccalaureate degrees, many of those first-generation college students often lack the family support systems that can be critical to help them stay in college once they get there. What's more, with the cost of college rising, simply paying for it can be tough. Working to address those issues and others affecting private higher education in the state is North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities. Formed in 1969, the Raleigh-based association serves as a statewide office for the state's 36 private, nonprofit colleges and universities. Enrollment totals 88,000 students at those schools, with North Carolinians accounting for 55% of their undergraduates. They employ about 65,000 people, making private education overall one of the largest private sector employers in the state, says Hope Williams, the organization's president. Operating with an annual budget of $1 million and a staff of 9 people, the association provides professional development for faculty and staff at its schools, group purchasing programs to facilitate cost savings, projects to increase student retention, collaboration with the UNC and community college systems, as well as the State Department of Public Instruction, public policy work and support for fundraising and academic programs. The Independent College Fund of North Carolina, a fund formed in 1953 that became part of the statewide group in 1995, for example, raised a record high $2.3 million in financial support for scholarships and programs at its schools in the last fiscal year. With $852,000 this year from a $4 million federal grant to the state, the association is providing mini grants and other support to increasing retention of students. Funded in part through support from the Cannon Foundation in Concord, collaboration also is a big focus of the organization. Student identification card system recently made available through the association, for example, meant a 25% discount on a $400,000 system for its first user, Chowan University in Murfreesboro. And consulting services to recover state sales tax refunds that nonprofits can claim under state law helped recover more than $1 million for 4 institutions, says Chuck Taylor, director of the association's collaboration initiative. And thanks to advances in technology, he says, future collaborations could even include sharing professors. Williams says a possible effort by state lawmakers to rewrite the tax code could eliminate those refunds, a move that could mean the loss of more than $200 million for all nonprofits in the state, including $60 million for private colleges and universities. That could result in higher costs for students at those schools, where annual tuition and fees average just over $24,000, compared to a national average of $28,500 for private colleges and universities. The biggest challenge, William says, is affordability for students. This week's Legal Focus by Jim Verdonik. This article is entitled, Debates Need a Dose of Technology. He writes, did you watch the presidential debates that were held over the past few weeks? I started wondering whether there is a market opportunity to use technology to solve the presidential debate problems. What problems, you ask? Well, let's start with a moderator problem. After every debate, someone criticizes the moderator. Did the moderator interfere too much? Or not control the candidates? Or give one candidate too much time? Or too little time? Why not simply replace moderators with computers? Here's how technology could improve debates. The debate system rewards people for talking. Is talking really the most important thing presidents do? If so, that explains the mess we're in. How about rewarding strategy? Wouldn't it be great to know which candidate is the better strategic thinker? So let's borrow from a simple rule from a strategy game, chess. Each candidate has a computer time clock that starts with 45 minutes. The computer starts counting down the minute, the time, whenever the candidate speaks. When a candidate's clock reaches zero, the candidate can no longer talk. That would let the other candidate who has time remaining say whatever they want without rebuttal. To avoid that, candidates would think strategically to allocate their time. The current system rewards politicians for endless talking. If we penalize wasting time, shorter, disciplined answer will replace meandering. Shorter answers make it difficult to hide that your answers don't relate to the questions being asked. But what if candidates cheat and talk after their time is up? Or what if they resort to making distracting noises while their opponent talks? We could wire candidates to have computers deliver electric shocks to punish extraneous noise. No, I'm not talking about electrocuting someone to a catatonic state. Just use enough juice to wipe stupid grins off their faces. Both parties could agree on a list of open-ended debate questions. Slot machine technology could randomly select questions from the pool. Or perhaps candidates could spin a wheel of fortune to get questions. Think of the drama as the audience sees how close a candidate came to winning their jackpot question. Bells and whistles and lights could go off when certain questions come up. This could interest a whole new demographic group into the political system. Some people accuse moderators of affecting the debate with their intonation. We could avoid that by utilizing computer-generated voices. Some people talk to Apple's Siri more than to other people anyway. I'm sure this doesn't exhaust the possibilities, so I'm issuing this challenge to America's entrepreneurs. Send me your ideas for saving presidential debates with new rules and new technologies. This week's guest column is from Andrew Broad. Mr. Broad is a senior research fellow at UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. His article is entitled Focus on Trends from Unemployment Report, Not Numbers from a Single Month. On the first Friday of each month, the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its employment situation report. The eagerly awaited report includes the national unemployment rate and the level of payroll employment, the number of jobs, for the previous month. It's not uncommon for the report to move the stock market that day if there are surprises in the data. Last month, the surprise was a big drop in the national unemployment rate in September, down 0.3% percentage points to 7.8%. It was less of a surprise to the markets than it was to political pundits. The rate hasn't been that low since January 2009, the month President Obama took office, and prominent conservatives expressed doubts about a number that was so good for the president so close to the election. There was even talk that the BLS had cooked the books to help the president. Of course, that was silly, as it would have required the silence and complicity of scores of BLS economists and administrators hired under both parties. There are no political appointees currently serving in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Moreover, a 0.3-point drop in the unemployment rate isn't unprecedented even in recent years. We saw declines that big or bigger in May 2010, December 2010, and January 2011, but without conspiracy theories. None of this is to suggest that the September number is correct, just that if it's wrong for statistical reasons, not political ones. The BLS goes to great pains to get the numbers right, issuing revisions to the data when new information comes in. Apparently, that doesn't sit well with Daryl Issa, the Republican chair of the House Oversight Committee. Issa didn't say anything about a conspiracy, but he said statistics that get revised don't put them out if they're going to be wrong by as much as half a point. Unfortunately, there's no free lunch in government statistics. If we want our data quickly, we have to accept revisions. If we can't accept revisions, we'll have to wait longer for the data. But it's fair to say that financial markets prefer quick data. Markets are generally good at assessing which data are believable and which should be discounted. The episode also revealed something more fundamental about elections and economic data. Yes, the unemployment rate is a strong predictor of voter behavior, but it's not because voters pay attention to economic indicators. It's because those indicators are highly correlated with the underlying economic realities that voters know very well. They react to their economic circumstances, not the data, per se. Economists routinely warn us not to assign much weight to a single month's number and instead to watch the trend. That's especially true in this case because the trend reflects what voters are actually reacting to. Right now, things are trending in the right direction in the job market, even if the trend isn't nearly as strong as we'd like. Since the labor market bottomed out in early 2010, the unemployment rate has fallen steadily as the U.S. economy has added an average of 137,000 jobs per month, enough to keep up with labor force growth and then some. There will be one more release of the Employment Situation Report before the election on November 2nd. Maybe the October unemployment rate will tick back up by a tenth of a point. Maybe not. But either way, the voters have probably already decided what they think of the economy. What's in a name? A lot, when it's also a brand. Thus, SAS Institute Incorporated is suing a similarly named French company, claiming trademark infringement and false advertising, among other issues. SAS Group's name and logos confuse potential clients and falsely imply an endorsement or relationship, Womble Carlyle attorney Press Millen wrote on behalf of the Cary-based company, one of the world's largest provider of business analytics software. The French company develops websites and e-commerce portals. SAS, Cary's SAS, that is, filed its lawsuit in federal court in Raleigh on August 7th. The company is asking for an unspecified amount in damages. But SAS, the one in France, whose website is sasgroup.com, responds that it has registered its names and trademark in France, and it doesn't do business in the United States. U.S. courts don't have jurisdiction in the issue, SAS, the French one, wrote in its October 19th response. Northgate Mall in North Durham and one of its food gallery merchants, Jake's Wayback Burgers, will host a food drive on November 10th to benefit Durham Rescue Mission during the holiday season. Jake's Wayback Burgers will give out free bags of its homemade chips along with coupons for a future purchase to anyone who brings canned or non-perishable food items to the drive. The event will be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Plaza at Northgate on Gregson Street. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.